In choosing the name Benedict XVI, the Pope made it clear where his priorities are: a return to Christ in a de-Christianized Europe, peace, and ecumenism. Well, Pope Benedict is expected to move ahead on all of these fronts as his papacy progresses. One of his greatest concerns where Europe is concerned is a prevailing moral relativism.
This is one of the deep wounds in the European soul that has to be healed before European society can be healed.
Father Vincent Toomey studied theology under Professor Joseph Ratzinger at Regensburg University in Germany. Today, he himself is professor of moral theology at St. Patrick's University in Maynooth, Ireland. But just what does this lofty term, moral relativism, really mean? And how might the new pope deal with the problem? Father Toomey brings the philosophical terminology down to earth in an interview with Michael Kelly.
Well, it really means that there is no such thing as right or wrong, that everything really is dependent on circumstance or situation or individual motivation. But the fact that there are certain actions which are right or wrong, irrespective of the situation, that's denied by a lot of people in practice and by a lot of theologians, moral theologians in theory. And it was to counter this that the late Pope John Paul II wrote his wonderful encyclical Veritatis Splendor, which means really the brilliance of truth. Moral relativism really comes down to the simple kind of assumption that there is no real truth which can guide our actions and which ultimately measures, for example, our actions, also measures the law by which we live. And if you deny that, you end up with the principle of the jungle that might is right.
Now, Father, how does this play itself out in contemporary society?
Well, it means other criteria are used when difficult decisions have to be made, for example, with regard to laws and with regard to legislating for moral behavior. That's one obvious way. Usually some form of utilitarianism, as they say, comes in. In other words, what is useful, what's useful to society, what's useful to people themselves becomes the criterion. And so, for example, in the whole question of cloning of human beings, of experimentation on human embryos, really the question is not asked, is this right or wrong, but how useful is this going to be to society? Above all, they mean, of course, to big business, because the governments who are trying to actually approve of such experimentation, they really are being pushed by the pharmaceutical industries and other industries, by other interest groups, powerful groups, who in actual fact want to do things that we all know in our heart and soul is wrong, namely to kill innocent children in the womb, to use even the very earliest sign of human life for purposes which are not at all related to the goodness of that human being. Now, on a personal level, of course, it is also ends in anarchy, in actual fact, where people just do what they feel like. What people feel like, of course, is a very shallow basis on which to base our decisions. And effectively, you'll find people just doing what they want to do, what satisfies them, without asking, well, is this right or wrong? And that, of course, leads to terrible unhappiness in society, because we are made for happiness, and the whole purpose of God's moral law, which is written into our very beings, which has been revealed by God in the course of revelation in Scripture and in the person of Jesus Christ, this law is there for us. It's the way, the only way, by which we can achieve happiness in this life and in the next life to come. By abandoning the law written into our being, the moral order, which is part of our created being, we effectively, even though we're getting pleasure for the moment, we actually are destroying ourselves in the process. And so you have a lot of disillusionment, bitterness, you've got a lot of helplessness, hopelessness, despair, ultimately suicide, if there is no criterion and no acceptance, general acceptance in society, that there are actually moral criteria which God has given to us for our own good and in order to bring us to the happiness we all in the depths of our hearts desire.
Father, what place can this objective morality play in a pluralist society? Many people will argue that that this is simply moral teaching for Christians.
Well, the whole notion of pluralism is a very vague notion as well. There are different cultures, there are different political parties and all the rest of it. But the extraordinary thing about moral law is that it manifests itself in different cultures, but it's the very same law. And to tell a lie is wrong, whether you are a German or an Irishman or a Chinese or a Congolese or a South American. You know, the whole question of modern pluralist societies, of course, are affected by this. Everybody realizes that society, with regard to its concrete decisions, allows of a plurality of opinions as to what should be done. But there isn't a plurality of opinions about the moral law, in other words, about the framework within which these decisions can be made. There are certain parameters which we may not transgress. And what the Church is teaching, especially with regard to acts which are wrong in themselves, intrinsically wrong, it is saying it doesn't matter what the reason is, no matter what good purpose it might achieve, you cannot kill an innocent person, for example. You cannot deliberately kill an innocent person. You cannot kill the child in the womb. You cannot kill the old person who is comatose. This is to kill something in you, which is extremely precious. And that, what is in you, of course, is your call to become one with God.
Our Holy Father Benedict XVI has written and spoken quite a lot about false understandings of pluralism and the danger this can have, particularly in a European context, yes?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you see, Europe is where all our problems are at the moment, and these are world problems ultimately, because Europe spreads its ideas throughout the whole world, especially in the age of mass communications. But the Europe, of course, has lived under the shadow of two ideologies, primarily, you know, the Nazi ideology and the communist ideology, and in reaction to the Second World War, where a certain view was imposed on society, a wrong view, namely the Nazi ideology and Marxist ideology. A number of thinkers like the great philosopher Isaac Berlin in Oxford argued that this horror of the Holocaust, etc., was due to the imposition on society of a particular value system. And this gave rise then to kind of moral relativism, though he himself recognized that despite his own, as it were, advocacy of respecting the different cultures and their own intrinsic value systems, which of course is essential, there are nonetheless acts which every culture will have to ignore, have to abide by, has to legislate against, for example, and cannot tolerate. But unfortunately, in the debate after the war, the horror of the imposed ideologies led, in reaction, I think, to so-called liberal approach, where people are free. Now, it's also associated with the whole philosophic tradition in Europe going back to the Enlightenment, which in effect, as it were, decoupled morality from in relation to God. And this has had profound implications, leading ultimately to the autonomy of the individual, that the individual himself has to decide what is right and wrong. And of course, theologically, we are back in the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve ate the tree of good and evil, and that was the fall. Yeah. So moral relativism is a very complex phenomenon. Pope Benedict XVI has written, as you said, as Cardinal, as Professor, and then as Cardinal Ratzinger, very eloquently on these issues and their roots in the European philosophical and indeed theological traditions, if you wish. What he's going to do about it is very, very hard. It's he certainly has brought the subject into the public arena for public debate. He has no illusions that he himself is not going to solve it. But there are other voices being heard at the moment from within the secular philosophical world which are saying similar things. So I think his priority of, you know, his highlighting of this question will mean that it will get a much better airing in the future. And this is one of the deep wounds at the heart in the European soul that has to be healed before European society can be healed.
You yourself studied under Professor Ratzinger and kept in contact with him throughout the years. And obviously, yes. One gives one's obedience to whoever's elected pope. But you must
of
have
course.
Some personal feelings about this man becoming Benedict the 16th.
I have many personal feelings of joy, of course, and gratitude to God for having the privilege of knowing the man and having the privilege also of studying under him and studying his writings. But also the privilege of having, as a teacher, a man who allowed me to think and who allowed his students to find their own paths. And he has, in effect, given me the template that I use for my own teaching, such as it is. Of course, it's only a poor substitute, but I'm very grateful to him for so much, for his friendship, of course, and for his example as a scholar and as a man of prayer and a man of the Church. The other feeling I have is gratitude to God for doing again what he did with John Paul II, preparing a man whose whole life, really, looking back on it now, and hindsight is great in that sense. I think you can see from the very his very early days how God had been preparing him, how all his studies have prepared him for the enormous task which he has today. I think if John Paul II was known as the universal pastor of the Church, I think Pope Benedict XVI would be called the universal teacher of the Church. And he will teach in a different way. John Paul II has already laid the foundations for a new moral thinking, philosophical and theological, in Europe and in the world. He has laid the foundations for new theologies of the Eucharist, Our Lady, the theology of the body, etc., etc. And he has produced wonderful documents, all of which have to be studied, and all of which will take a long time to absorb. I think the present Pope will communicate, will teach more as the great fathers of the Church of old. In other words, he will teach through his sermons, through meeting people, through exchanges with people. He will, I think the spoken voice will probably take on a greater role with him as a teacher. And he will meet people and win them over. And as one of my students in a seminar I held this morning said, you know, if love is the prerequisite of truth, you know, and you have to win people's hearts before you can speak to their minds. And I think that this is what Cardinal Ratzinger will do to those who have the privilege of meeting him, as I had the privilege of not only meeting him, but studying him and sharing in the circle of friends, which is his student in Christ.
Father Vincent Toomey, Professor of Moral Theology at St. Patrick's University in Maynooth, Ireland. And now Susie Hodges takes a closer look at some of the other issues of concern facing the Church in Europe.
Europe is the traditional home of the Church, but in recent decades it has been beset by a variety of new challenges and problems. Most European countries face an increasing shortage of priests. So could this be the greatest challenge facing the new pontiff? A question I put to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, Deputy Secretary General of the European Council of Catholic Bishops.
I think in some countries people feel there's a great shortage of priests. In other countries, the statistics are similar and people don't feel there's a great shortage of priests. It depends on the outlook. For example, where I live now in Switzerland, people feel there's a shortage of priests. But they don't do too much about finding new ones, and structures have been put in place where priests are not really needed. I don't want to comment too much on that, since I'm only a guest in that country. Although, I have to confess, I think it's a short-sighted approach. In my own country, in England, there are sort of similar statistics, but there seems to be both an attempt to put new energy into finding new priests. There are very energetic people being put into the position of National Vocations Director, and they have a good team, and they work with the teams locally. So there is great energy being put into suggesting the possibility of vocation to young men. At the same time, there's been a great adaptation to the lower numbers, and lay people have become involved and realised they can do so much in the church without huge revolutionary change, just that, you know, things that priests did, many of them have been taken over very happily by lay people, and there's a much more cooperative ministry going on in many places.
Rising secularism, materialism and the impact of globalisation are other key issues facing the church in Europe. So could these too be big challenges for the new Pope?
It's easy to say words like secularism and materialism. It's harder to define what you mean. Now, all isms are a bit dangerous in the sense that they can be caricatures of points of view. I don't think the points of view are as important as the conditions in which people live. And to mention globalisation, I think the important thing there is about how people survive and how human their life is. There's a great phrase in the Gospel somewhere, man was not made for the Sabbath was made for man. I'm sure there must be a more politically correct translation of it nowadays, but please bear with me on that one. But the idea is all our religion is to make human beings more human. And if it doesn't, if it detracts from that humanity, it's not doing its job. Sometimes the battle, when people speak of secular laws and secular states like France and Belgium a little bit, and when they speak of materialist viewpoints, they seem to be reacting against bad forms of religion, and very often those are in the distant past nowadays, thank goodness. There seems to be a historical clash of views, and really where people have come to blows, in a sense, is when religion has not served humanity in the judgment of some people. I think those are the main challenges, rather than the ideology. I don't think an ideological battle is going to help many people put food on their plate, for example, if they haven't got any. And the church is one of the organizations which is meant to humanize life rather than take away the humanity. So I think the center of the argument is really there rather than in the list of things we believe in and don't believe in.
That was Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, Deputy Secretary General of the European Council of Catholic Bishops. I'm Susie Hodges.